Holton, I have the privilege of facilitating our process. And this morning, we are joined by our mayor, Mayor Ted Wheeler. And let me refer to you, sir.
Great. Well, thank you all for being here. I'm sorry, this is sort of going to be like a quick hit and run on my part. I have council session in 24 minutes. And the council actually expects me to be well prepared for it. Go figure. But I did want to be here at this meeting of the Bond Oversight Committee, just first of all to introduce myself and say hello, and assure you this will not be my last opportunity to be here. I wanted to thank you. You're obviously going to spend a considerable amount of time getting oriented and understanding what's going on and how you're going to be useful to the effort. I just want to say very clearly that the city at large and the city council in particular rely heavily on citizen engagement. Most all of you have been active before in other citizen engagement capacities. Jess and I think I see Jess more than I see my wife at this point.
Sorry.
We are all on the council, I speak for all of us, we are so appreciative that people are willing to make the time commitment and the energy commitment, particularly given that all of you have busy lives. The issue of affordable housing is paramount to this community. It is clearly the greatest immediate challenge that we are facing, and it bleeds over into so many other areas. It bleeds into the homeless crisis, it bleeds into the educational achievement gap issue, it bleeds over into economic development and prosperity issues as people move farther from employment chasing housing affordability. It bleeds into the broader conversations we've been having about support for community institutions, because as housing mobility increases, the ability of community institutions, I mean, just think about a church, for example, in Northeast Portland, or even think about an educational institution like a Self-Enhancement, Inc. Community institutions start to wither as housing stability is upended by this affordability crisis. So there are so many reasons why this is critically, critically important. And the work that you do is truly historic. The bond that was approved by the voters is historic. And it was a broad and loud statement on behalf of the people in this community that this issue is very important to them. They were willing to put their dollars and their cents on the table with the hope and the expectation that we would spend those dollars wisely, we'd spend them effectively in terms of helping to address this crisis, which they see as important. You're right at the center of it. So where we are in the process right now, the so-called Stakeholder Advisory Committee, or the SAG, is coming to the completion of their work. Their job is basically to set some goals and to set a broad framework for how bond dollars would be expended. You'll learn a lot more about that later. They are now taking the rough framework out to their community coalitions to vet those ideas. And they'll come back as a committee and they'll have a couple of more meetings and they'll discuss what they've learned as they've been out in the community. That framework will go to the City Council for approval, I am hoping, on October 11th. That's the objective. You will then, as a Bond Oversight Committee, work within the confines, or the structure is probably better. Confines is the wrong word, it's too restrictive, but within the structure of that framework. They've already set some very aggressive goals. You've probably heard some of these goals. They're seeking at least 1,300 new units with this bonding capacity, and they've targeted 600 at 60% MFI or lower. Is that MFI or AMI?
AMI.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So it's 600 at 60% AMI. There are other criteria that they've established as well. They want family-sized units, and you'll see other criteria come forward as well. That 1,300 units, just to be clear, and I don't see anybody from the press here this morning, I always hate to establish objective standards because then the whole story becomes, did they meet the objective standard or didn't they? And the reality is this, that objective standard assumes that we take the bond dollars and we leverage it with other resources like community development block grants, or we're the last dollars in, we're leveraging private sector resources. So it is an aspirational objective as opposed to a standard that we either blow through or fail to achieve. And I just want to be really, really clear about that, because I'm sort of tired of us putting aspirational goals out there and then having the frame of the conversation with the public be, well, they set high goals for themselves and they failed. We should set high goals, just to be clear. So I hope you won't be cowed by that, but I want you to be careful about how you talk about the standards as they come to you and you look at them. So I've got a few more minutes. I definitely want to take any questions you may have, and I know right now you have probably more questions than answers about your work. And you'll be well taken care of on that front. The Housing Bureau will be available to you. Shannon has just started. She's the second day into her job with the Housing Bureau. She's the point person on the bond. And so she's already an expert. She's been with Commissioner Saltzman. She was, working on housing issues many, many, many more years before I ever even thought about going into public service. Of course, Kurt is here as the director of the Bureau. Cupid has been very, very engaged in this process. And there's a lot of people here who are experts, Jess and others, who know this stuff inside and out. You will be brought up to speed. But if there's any questions I can answer right now, I'd be happy to do so. Yes, sir?
I should have a question, because this is sort of the second time a discussion about the 1,300 production goal has come up. It came up at SAG the other evening, kind of in a roundabout way. And I don't know that it's been couched as aggressive or as Jonathan from Home Forward said, that I thought it would be difficult to meet that goal. And it sort of hasn't been characterized to us that way. And the part that you added today that I'm curious about, and this is probably a question for the Bureau and maybe even for Carl, in the modeling we've seen, is it based on being able to leverage those other resources? So the numbers that he has in this model, I'm not sure that it actually identifies
I probably should have been more precise. No, those are unleveraged.
Okay.
But there is a question. There's lots of questions. He also raised the question of construction inflation, which is a very real issue right now.
Before we can spend dollars.
Right. So, today you might think you could put a new bathroom in for X dollars, but by the time you do it 8 months from now, it might be X times 1.3. So there's a lot of things that my cautionary note here is it is a framework, or it's like the pirate movie. It's more of a guideline. And I just want people to, as I said the other day, and I was very deliberate in saying it, when somebody asks me now, what's the deadline? It's as long as it takes to do it right. And when they ask me how much is it going to cost, I say however much it costs to do it right and be fiscally prudent. I'm never going to answer those questions again. I got asked on OPB on Think Out Loud the other day. I said as long as it takes to do it right. I could just sense the frustration, so I knew it was a great answer.
And just to backfill, Alan, I think we modeled those numbers in March of 2016.
Right.
And they were unleveraged, and they were rigorous but attainable, in my estimation. And it was predicated on 30% acquisition with rehab, 70% new construction. So to me, there are some levers available to you all and to the City Council. One is increase the amount of acquisition, decrease the amount of new construction. Now, that said, I fully expect the current frothy market to hit a flat spot.
Okay.
And I think we can pick up some good deals at the back end of that flat
spot.
Yes.
Maybe. But my point is, expect, my personal view is I actually think we're going to have to use some leverage. But we'll see. Yeah. Hopefully not.
Yeah.
In which case, we will exceed that 1,300.
So the nervousness really you're hearing is the 1% a month of cost inflation that has happened for the last 8 months. Because, people are taking note. I think you all, the Walsh Construction did provide actually a synopsis of 13 projects that they are currently under construction with, and they've seen cost inflation between 8% and about 12% in the last year. So that's real. It's labor, it's materials, it's unavoidable. And the I'd be happy to share that with the whole bond.
I think we didn't go to the bond oversight committee.
So, and as far as leverage is concerned, we can leverage debt from HUD, we can leverage other resources. It's the artificial entity issue,
right,
tax credit partnerships, and other trusts that we can't do business with. But we can do business with the federal government all day long.
I think as we move forward, it's important to work on the really, really specific and things that take a lot of brain damage, but also not lose sight of the low-lying fruit. This really came home for me last week. One of my neighbors on my street became homeless, and she showed up at our house Monday night, 11:30 at night, asking if she could sleep in our backyard. She had a tent, no shoes on, blisters on her feet, 5-year-old son. And I said, no, you can't in our backyard, but you can sleep in a room.
Yeah.
You can take one of our kids' rooms. And so she stayed with us for 4 days, and I called around looking for resources, spent hours on the phone, and all the answers were shelter. And everyone that I talked to said, you don't put kids in shelters. Meanwhile, two doors down from me, there's an affordable housing house that's been vacant for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Move-in ready, the lawn gets mowed.
Why
every
is it
2 weeks.
Vacant?
Pick a month, pick a different excuse. But I think from where I sit, I think it's, the metrics on the 1,300 units and $200,000 subsidy, if we do that right, great, but if we miss out on this stuff that doesn't cost us anything, or it's just organizations don't have capacity or whatever, we're gonna look like fools.
I agree.
And so, I don't know what staff can do, but I would love to know how many units out there are not currently occupied that our affordable housing partners currently have. And if something's going vacant for more than 3 months, that's move-in ready, that makes absolutely no sense.
When you're even more generous than I would, 3 months.
I understand this, but literally, I was calling hotels for this woman. Like,
thank you.
Who would take,
God, you're a good man.
A voucher? Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to want to do. It's another when someone's sleeping on a couch and they've got their cardboard sign, right? And so that's what you have to do. So to literally be two houses down from a three-bedroom, one-bath house that no one's lived in, it's embarrassing. And that's the kind of thing that I think the papers are always going to go after the 1300, but they find out about that kind of stuff happening. It's crazy.
So, Kurt, I think that's an excellent question that's been raised.
Yeah.
And we have certainly been pursuing the so-called zombie house issue. We have hundreds of vacant houses in this community that are tied up in various financial dealings, banks, foreclosures, estates,
yeah.
And unfortunately we find that the wheels of law turn slowly, and the balance is deliberately against the government being able to take
those
private
property. Those
are
different situations, right?
They are.
As opposed to organizations that are
right.
asking for money,
and
that, affordable housing.
That was my next point, is just if these are units that have been developed for the purpose of keeping people off the streets, why are they?
I think I know exactly what Stephen is referring to.
Can you look into that and let
me
know, because I'd like to know too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have an excellent
day. I'm getting
great counsel.
Thank you.
Kurt.
In our jurisdictions that have put in place mechanics around incentivizing those units not staying empty.
Right. And it's not about the blame game or whatever. It's about if we're going to use the word crisis and mean it, it's got to be like all hands on deck.
Yeah. All solutions.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Did you have any greeting or any statements you wanted to make?
There's nothing I can really add that the mayor hasn't already stated, other than to say that we wanted to make sure that as you delved into the bond, that you knew everything else that was going on at the Bureau, because of course we existed before the bond was even conceptualized, and we have a book of business that includes a very robust housing development pipeline of over 30 projects.
Thank you.
None of which are funded by the bond, because we haven't deployed those bond resources yet. So we want to make sure that you understand that workflow so that you can then understand how the bond adds value and what the interplay is between the bond resources and the other resources of the Bureau. Because you'll be asked those questions, which is, what about TIF? What about transient lodging tax? What about construction excise tax?
I did an interview last week with Oregonian, and they tried to say, well, there's no affordable housing. It's been done in 7 months. This, and I was like, so you realize the bond is just one tool, right? Mm-hmm. Have you driven on MLK lately?
Right, exactly. Good answer.
We want to welcome Shannon Callahan. This is her second day at the Portland Housing Bureau. So welcome, Shannon. Shannon, anything you want to say?
It is my great privilege to get to work with this committee and work on the bond in general. It is something that I feel very passionate about, and all the work at the Housing Bureau, and I just can't imagine a better group to be working with over the next
5 to 8 years.
So please know that if you need anything from me, if there's anything you need from the meeting perspective, would just like to have a conversation, I'm happy to do that. I also know that you did get some pretty rigorous instructions from city attorneys, but anything that I can do to help you in your mission, that's what I'm here to do. So, as well as work closely with the Bureau and help them deliver the 1,300 units at least.
Well, and just so you know, I have stated that I consider the 1,300 to be a moral and an ethical commitment of me personally and the Bureau. It may not be a legal expectation, and I think an aspirational goal would have been higher, frankly. Right. Could have been 1,750. I don't think it could have been 2,000. But we aim to exceed that number. And if I have to exceed that number with by adjusting things, we certainly will. Because while it's great to hear that the mayor is alloying that number, I personally know that I'm going to be on the hook to city council.
Excellent. Well, I want to make sure everyone is signing in. I think all of us have signed in. So if anyone has not, please, before we leave the day, get signed in. Matthew Schombold, you are here with us to help us go through the equity conversation, sir. So
yes.
Come and join us.
Turn the slide off here. The slide's a bit easier to see. Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is part two of maybe three parts of your onboarding into the Bureau and multifamily development. So I've got a couple of sections on the agenda today, the equity conversation and the internal functioning. So this is, you know, we talked about that the Bureau had the racial equity plan overall at the last meeting, and we presented it. We sent out the Excel workbook since it's impossible to read on paper. But for today, what I wanted to focus on was specifically how our multifamily development team actualizes equity when it comes to the buildings themselves. And so, Okay. So what I've got here to present today is some historical performance data, 2013 to 2016 data on performance targets around NWESB contracting utilization, as well as workforce training and hiring program requirements. And so this is how, to a large degree, the multifamily development program actualizes equity in its work outside of some process stuff that they've done in the past with regard to technical assistance or the selection process itself or more qualitative expectations around discussing equity and community benefits and different proposals that the Bureau receives. But as far as dollars going out the door, this is kind of what we've got. And you've got some slides in here. And what I just want to emphasize, that this is small, but what I want to emphasize is this is major projects on the multifamily side
between 2013 and 2016. And for just a guide really quick, again, blue, the blue coloring is an emerging small business. Red is women owned, orange is minority owned, and green is other. So that could just be as a non-MWSB, that's what the other category is. And so you can see that still a majority of the funding on a lot of projects does go to non-MWESP firms, but that the Bureau has had success in a lot of the projects in getting a sizable percentage of the funds to contractors or subcontractors that are MWESP. So again, what we're looking at here is, I think it's 14 of the projects that moved through the process. And you've got a breakdown. We can get the raw data too if you want, but we have the breakdown of the percentage of funds, contracting funds, by EWM or O businesses for each of the projects. As you can see, some are more successful, like the Allen Fremont Plaza, Hacienda, Maggie Gibson, PCRI, etc.
How big are those projects, man? Huh? How big are those projects?
So looking here, this is the scale. So. This is the Abigail Apartments, and it goes to, if you can't read, that's just under $30 million. And so that is the largest, and they get smaller.
So the best one, the Allen, is the smallest one.
Correct.
That's the other thing I was going to say, is, I mean, what do we know from this data? Because there's a wide gap in success, right, between the Abigail at 83% mm-hmm. and 83% other and the Allen. Like, seems that at 70%.
But it's, to me, it's about dollars. So right. Even if Abigail is 83%, if the 10% is minority and right. it's three times the dollar amount of the Allen, which seems better as a percentage, then, I mean, dollars seem to be the only thing that really makes sense.
Right, and we can slice this and come back with in any way you want, in terms of it can be dollar amounts. So this is just a sampling of graphs. Yep. And I think to your point too, though, it's around success. It depends on who you ask. And I think that's going to be important for this conversation and the bond, because the Bureau has been increasing its equity goals. And I think if Carl were here, he might say, well, we have been successful at meeting what our targets were. You know, originally, there was the Bureau followed the 20% city target around contracting. Then, and you'll see this later in my slides, but it increased to 30%. And that was just hard cost, and it now has transitioned to also including soft costs. So it, Jess?
Oh, I'll let you finish your statement.
Oh, no, I was just saying, so as far as historic performance, we have continued to meet with the performance targets, but it's a question of, is that the right target? And that is a conversation that the stakeholder group is gonna have around, I think not at the next meeting, but in two meetings around, what are our other policy goals as a part of putting the money out the door when we talk about procuring construction and development services. But it'll be a question about what is the right performance target.
Actually my question kind of maybe is better for that future meeting, but the criticism I've heard about MWESB as a metric of how we're meeting equity goals is that it measures ownership of the companies and not dollars in the pockets of people who are women, low income, communities of color.
We're getting there.
Oh, okay.
So that's the next set of slides. But we do track it.
Okay.
So we track that, and it's part of the workforce and hiring goals that the city has, which we could break out. I'll get
okay.
There. So here you see again, some of the smaller projects do have a higher percentage, but it is a lower total value of funds, and we can disaggregate it if you'd like, but. You know, we do have, I think, a fairly good spread across the projects. We tend to be more successful than the city on average overall. I'm not saying on every project or compared to every single institution, but on average, we perform better than the city overall.
Matt, is there any conversation around the green is pretty big. Is there any goals around, I'm going to assume that part of that green group could be certified. They qualify to become certified. Is there any work done internally to say, hey, Cupid, we love that you're doing this work. We can't count you towards our numbers. You're in the other category, but you could be an MBE. Is there someone that goes and works with them to say, hey, part of our success was we got three people certified that otherwise weren't certified?
You know, both the multifamily and the single family staff work with our contractors to help them understand the certification process and then move them through it if they'd like.
If they'd like.
And I know on the single family side, because it tends to be smaller contracts, a lot of folks don't want to go through the process. I don't know on the multifamily side, but I'll check in with Bobby Daniels is a lead person for us on that, on the multifamily. And I'll check in with him and Carl and find out if, you know, something that we just got presented at PHAG yesterday afternoon was a single family staff have actually polled their contractors, and there's a large percentage that would self-identify as a woman-owned or minority-owned business but didn't go through the certification process. So we can see if we can find that out, if that's done on the multifamily program side as well. So if you look at, this is just kind of, again, this is the same data, same projects, but it's the major construction firms. And so you can see when, based, and I don't, you might be able to read this in your slides, based on who the prime, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Who the prime general contractor was, what their success at utilizing ESB, WBE, MBE subcontractors are. So to kind of break this down in more understandable terms, if you look here where Colas was the prime or the general contractor, this was the split amongst OBE, MBE, WBE, and ESB. So this is how you look at it. We took what our major prime general contractors on these projects that you see right here, just to kind of give it more of a dollar breakdown.
So if I understand correctly, Colas did essentially $15 million in projects in comparison to Walsh doing roughly 40, and they did triple the amount to MBEs?
Yes. I mean, in dollar terms, it looks like that. I'd want to double check the numbers, but yeah, it looks like that. Yeah. So that's how you read. And again, we're able to slice this any way
exactly
you want. We have a pretty good data set when it comes to being able to track this by project or by general contractor, subcontractor. Subcontractors may be a little more challenging, but we could get into it. And then again, here you just see it as a percentage and not a dollar amount.
Can I ask a question? Sorry, Matt. As a PHP contractor, you know, on the nonprofit side, we're asked about the demographics of our organization. Does that kind of look through data be available for these firms also?
We don't collect that that's not on the development awards, that's only on our contractor services.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can tell you for Walsh, they have zero people of color on their website as of last week.
Yeah, so
zero.
Yeah, so from an equity perspective, it might be a piece that
We can certainly, like I said,
be difficult.
We can certainly incorporate this. Like, this is not to say that this is the standard, but that this is what is currently used. And then with regard to the bond funds, the stakeholder group and you as an oversight group will certainly get to weigh in on whether or not this is acceptable or this plus something is preferred. So, okay, then we move into where Jess was going, which is project work hours. And so project work hours is just simply they take the total number of work hours on a particular project for all of the workers that are reported to the city. And it's actually reported to the city procurement office, not to the housing bureau. And then we can break that data down at a pretty detailed level and in a lot of different ways. So this is just a sampling of how we can break the data down. So this is a percentage of work hours for the Housing Bureau projects, 2014-2016. You have a sampling of six projects there. So it's not all of them from before. We took six projects. And you can see the race ethnicity of the workers on those projects overall.
And is that just people engaged in the trades, or is that everyone?
It's in the trades, because it just aggregates it by trades. But it's at journey and apprentice levels.
Okay. So if someone's got somebody in the back office doing spreadsheets,
yeah. This is just trades. Oh. This is just trades. Yeah. So, and then here are the other ones right here. So you can see the success is it varies based on the project in terms of the percentage of the workers that are minority. And we can also break this down by gender, and by gender, our contractors are just not performing. It's just not, it's not going well. Very, very small percentage of women that have project work hours on any of these projects.
And that's actually kind of what I was asking about. So yeah, the same question that Jess had. So that's actually not wrong. It wasn't necessarily ownership.
Okay.
But that's only the trades, it's not the other things associated with the project.
All right.
Right, as the trades.
So in the soft cost part, you wouldn't see that either then?
Well, we'll get there. So then you can also break down the project work hours by trade and by race. And this is pretty important. I don't have the spreadsheet in these slides, but I can present it, because all of these have substantially different pay rates, right? Some of these are the lowest paying trade jobs in the industry, and some of them are the highest paying trade jobs. But what this lets you do, we could do it by project, but we did not present it here. We'd be another 20 slides or so if we were going to do it by project, but we can and we're willing to. This gives you project work hours by trade, by race. So for instance, if you're looking at insulation has almost 69% of the project work hours were done by Latino workers. Versus if you were an equipment operator, 92% were done by white workers. And so there's 20-something total project work hours, but it allows us to look by project to understand, well, okay, who is working on what particular trade. And we can actually even then disaggregate this further if we wanted to look at journey versus apprentice to get an understanding of how established they are in the trade and what their compensation might be. I think the challenge on this, the city does have goals around workforce hiring and training. We don't currently disaggregate by trade. We don't currently say, okay, here are all the different trades you're going to have on a project. Here are all the targets. Like I said, I don't think that that's infeasible. I do think it does make a project more complicated if you were to say, we're going to have a target for each of the 20 trades around MWSB project work hours. Because I think what we hear right now is that there is a shortage of labor. And it is pretty hard because MWSB firms overall are in pretty high demand. And then there's a question of, well, if we start to set this, how complicated does it get for a general contractor to go out and find subs that specifically can commit a percentage of project work hours? Okay, it's not to say that we're not willing to have the conversation, but I wanted to flag that it's not something that the city or the bureau currently sets as a target. We don't disaggregate that. So again, as you want more information, as you want to think through this more, we have a very big data set when it comes to this, and we can cut the data set and analyze it however you'd like.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Someone who has very little, maybe zero familiarity with the trades, is it correct to assume those trades that have nearly 100% Caucasian workers are generally the higher paying trades?
I think what I would say is that if you looked at all 20-something, I would do the inverse, right? With a couple of outliers, that the trades that have lower wages tend to have the higher percentage of communities of color. That's not to say that you don't have anomalies, right? Mm-hmm. There are anomalies in here about where it falls in the middle of the wage scale at the low end that's substantially white. It just may have to do with whoever the subcontractor was, but kind of collectively, yes, that is something we see in the data.
Thank you.
I think, Jess, that's also a function of generational dynamics. So like the average age of the white community in Oregon is 41 versus the Latino community is 28. So all things being equal, someone who's in the trades who's 13 years younger than someone else is probably at a lower wage scale, is probably earlier on in their hours.
So moving from kind of a historic performance, 2013 to 2016, I want to talk specifically about the 2015-2017 NOFA. And, you know, keep in mind, there's overlap. The 2016 data does not reflect the 2015 NOFA, right? 2015 NOFA awards are just being built right now. So the data we just looked at was after the projects were complete. So it's projects that were complete by 2016. I guess for folks that aren't familiar with NOFA, NOFA is traditionally how our multifamily development program puts money out the door. They'll advertise that there are funds available, and they'll collect proposals and go through some sort of review process, and then the funds are awarded. And so we had a NOFA in the fall of 2015, and we had another NOFA in January, February of 2017. And there were, it was an allocation of a large amount of funding. I think somewhere between $65 and $90 million total between those two NOFAs. So what this is an outline of what the specific equity performance targets were in the two NOFAs. So as far as DMWESB contract utilization, it was that, like I said, we've been slowly increasing the target percentage, but either 20 or 30% of hard construction and development costs were DMWESB firms. And then in the 2017 NOFA only, the multifamily team incorporated soft costs. So, you know, things like architecture, engineering, professional services. And so that was the first NOFA in which there was a soft cost performance target, and it was set at 20%. And then there, within these larger targets of the 20 to 30% and the 20%, there's a specific performance target of 14% is DMWB, so not an emerging small business, but a disadvantaged minority or women-owned business enterprise. And then as far on the workforce training and hiring program requirements, it's 20% of labor hours for apprenticeships, and 12 to 15% of labor hours are women, and 27 to 30% of labor hours are for minorities. So those are the workforce training and hiring targets that were in the 15 NOFA and the 17 NOFA. And then for the 17 NOFA, there is also a supplemental in the interstate corridor funds. There was an ask for a development benefit agreement that went beyond simply the DMWESB and the workforce training and hiring, but speaking to on a broader level understanding of kind of racial equity issues in Northeast Portland and what other sorts of benefits the proposal would provide, the development team would provide beyond these base targets. So that is in the 15 NOFA and the 17 NOFA, those are kind of the key performance targets that have been utilized around racial equity and specifically around dollars or tangible benefits to the community in the context of the 2017. So again, this is not to say this has to be the standard, but this is our operating baseline at this point. And so with regard to the bond, there's going to be a question to both the stakeholder group and the oversight, you as the oversight body, as to whether or not this is sufficient or if you all want it scaled up. And then here I just provided a list of other kind of racial equity and community benefit best practices that occur not specific to Portland, but they can occur across the board, right? It's contracting and subcontracting, which we do that, right? Hiring workforce, we do that here. Wage rate establishment, that can be things around, you know, BOLI or prevailing wage or some other sort of wage rate establishment. We don't really do anything beyond BOLI and prevailing wage. BOLI or Davis-Bacon. Project work hours, which again, we do kind of incorporate that into our workforce training and hiring. Apprenticeships, which we do incorporate. Different community oversight committees that oversee certain aspects of a development project. Different from this, which is overseeing a bond overall, but specifically looking at a development project. Training and outreach support funds. Non-project community benefits. I know that it's not on here, but I think one that comes up is we've had public testimony at the stakeholder group several times now, and I can't remember if he came to the oversight committee at the last meeting, but around wage theft, an initiative to incorporate into some sort of non-project community benefits around investigating wage theft on projects to make sure that people weren't being paid at a different wage rate than was being reported to the city through unscrupulous business practices. So there's a lot of other sorts of community benefits and racial equity practices out there. But I also wanted you all to get an understanding of, on our, at least on our multifamily development
side program, what the, kind of the current standard is that we're operating under. So. So if you think about this and you have questions, but again, the from a process standpoint, the stakeholder group will take this up in a couple minute meetings, not the next one, but it should be the one after next, maybe the second or third meeting from today, as a part of just a general kind of process, because these issues have come up as folks have had questions about what does the city's procurement process look like, what is, you know, how are the funds going to be used? And then there will be a draft plan, and this body will get to weigh in on that draft plan, even though the ask is at the SAG to put together that draft plan. And so this is something that we'll definitely be seeking feedback on as to whether or not our current standard is sufficient or if there's an interest in something more substantial. So, all right, I guess I'm next. giving an overview of
yes, Matt Schaubold is next to go over.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
PHP internal functioning. Let's welcome Matt to.
I think this is not.
There's Shannon.
No. So this is a little hard to. Is there a Zoom button?
Yeah, there is.
Ah, here we go. It's, you know, they don't, this is great because our, I think this will cover it. You don't need to be able to read this. I just wanted to use this as a guide for walking you through the Bureau. I can't see it on here. We have this incompatibility between our projectors and our new laptops. Gotta love technology. So I was asked to come and just kind of give a basic, as a part of the onboarding, a basic overview of internal functioning of the Bureau. So this is our organizational chart. It's still in draft form. It hasn't been finalized yet. It should be finalized in the next couple days, and then it'll get posted to the web. It'll be added to our budget documents and things like that. But it gives a general overview of the Bureau. So I'm just gonna really quickly hit each section and then do my best to answer questions about the sections to the degree that there are questions. But we also have other staff here who might be able to answer questions about the sections as well. So you've got Kurt, the director, and then Shannon, Javier, and Leslie at the executive team level, and they are overseeing most of the functions of the Bureau. Starting on this side, Leslie's the business operations manager, and within there's the finance and accounting shop, which is also inclusive of loan servicing, so a lot of our loan products, they'll actually service those. And then our data analytics staff, and so they do a lot of data analysis and data collection. It's inclusive of performance data, and so on all of our contracts, as well as managing some data systems for the city, Multnomah County, and some regional partners. So that's kind of all captured in the data section of the Bureau. The administrative services team and human resources, and they provide the administrative support functions for the Bureau for these meetings, and then HR obviously hiring. And recruitment and retention of staff. Within here, there's kind of a new position that we're recruiting for, right, Javier?
Yes.
It's around city-owned property management, so we're increasingly owning more property. We don't have a staff, but that's their primary responsibility to manage kind of that function, and so that's a red is a vacant and or future position. That's something we'll be bringing on here. We have our risk analysis and compliance section of the Bureau, and they're really responsible for, you know, we have regulatory agreements with over somewhere between 13 and 14,000 units right now in the city, and those regulatory agreements require all sorts of reporting on an annual basis around the tenants that are in them and other sorts of regulatory rules, and that's the team that takes on that function.
Also
inclusionary housing, the regulatory compliance functions within inclusionary housing. This is our, HIP team. It's the multifamily team. I think HIP stands for Housing Investment, Production, and Preservation, which I don't think regular humans understand. So it's multifamily. It's our multifamily programs, which is inclusive of our loan products. Mandatory inclusionary housing is nested there, as well as any other kind of one-time initiatives we have around multifamily development. And I would say rental, because they're also increasingly taking a role in the multifamily ownership space. And then over here is our single family team. And you know, this is, I think that there's some transitioning happening as single family used to be primarily ownership, and ownership related programs or multifamily is rental, and there's more blending now, so we'll have some sorting out to do. But this is our single family team. And they'll manage things like our down payment assistance loan programs, our home repair programs, our lead grants, lead mitigation grants. We've got some indirect programs around tax exemptions for single family home buyers. That's all nested here in the single family team. And then over here, we've got equity, policy, planning, and communications. So those are kind of the main functional areas of the Bureau. I don't think I'm going to take all the time on there unless there are questions. I guess as it relates to your work, you know, you're working a lot with our equity policy and planning staff right now as we put together, we work with the stakeholder group to put together the framework for the use of the bond funds, the policy framework. But when we transition into actually implementing the plan, you'll be working significantly with the multifamily team, which is managed by Carl, with the finance and accounting team, managed by Mike, and then I'm sure you will interact closely with, potentially with our risk analysis and compliance staff, as well as our data staff, as you start to, you know, look for more information and get a better understanding of the actual operations of buildings or assessment of success in meeting different performance targets. That's kind of the overall structure of the Bureau as it currently stands.
Matt, how many positions do you expect to add because of the bond, due to the spending the bond money, because those projects are owned by PHB?
I would defer to Javier on that one. I think we've already started to restructure a bit to be able to meet the needs of the bond, but in the long term, I would defer to Javier and Mike.
Probably clear we may have added about five. I mean, the fall bump last year, we had five positions, and a lot of that was building capacity to do the work we're looking at. An example of the property management position there, which is going to be really managing the relationships with the third party building managers. Yeah. One of the positions added then. There was some capacity added to, I believe you added a position at that point in time also. So at this point about five, I mean, I could envision, and Javier, correct me if I'm wrong, that once we get beyond the four apartment buildings the Bureau owns now, we actually owned a couple before our latest acquisition, so we're kind of moving in this direction anyway. Maybe adding another position on the property management side as that volume grows. I think Matt had a very good point when he was talking about synergy between neighborhood housing and multifamily team, that synergy kind of changing how they work together. That's happening with virtually all of the teams now. That's part of how we're dealing with this new line of work and working on the bond. So for example, folks on my team are going to be starting to work even more with the risk analysis team and the property management mini team as it grows. And that's going to create some capacity to do more and more of the manage the buildings, manage the bond. Similar with the data team, because now that's a new set of data requiring reporting on what we're doing with the bond that they're going to have to take on. So there may be some additional positions we look at adding as we get down the road, but we've also got to be cognizant of what we can afford to pay for, because Bureau is changing. You're seeing some new teams show up as we get more into owner-renter services. There may be another team that pops up here. As we get more into building management, as I mentioned, I see another position pop up there. We're also going to be transitioning out of a lot of the TIF resources we have. So how that's going to affect gap financing we do, it may not have an impact on staffing, because we've got plenty of existing portfolio management to do as part of the portfolio preservation is what the two P's are for in PIP. So it's housing investment portfolio preservation, and there's a lot of work out there to do on that. So there is that workload there. So it's really a matter of trying to morph what we have to fit the new things we're going to do.
And the other flag I put out there, and Mike alluded to this, you know, we have done some restructuring and added some positions, but also because of the city's decision to adopt a mandatory inclusionary housing policy, which requires staff to administer, so there's been some restructure as well as added positions, and then increasing into landlord-tenant affairs, landlord-tenant regulation and services. We've got some vacant positions, and I would imagine changes, we could even see further changes in the structure. So there's just a lot, just re-emphasize, there's a lot of change from a different number of program areas, inclusive of the bond being done.
Just out of curiosity, where is the renter owner going to land in this chart?
Well, you know, it's really, right now there's the policy, equity policy planning team are doing a lot of it, most of it, and there are two positions currently working their way through the HR process. One is a housing policy analyst, and the other is a housing data analyst position to take on kind of the policy development role and the data analysis role. But it's really a question of what city council wants implemented, right? At this point, there's been supplemental landlord-tenant law, which the city doesn't currently have a role in terms of information dissemination and actually training organizations on what it is. It's just the law. And then there's all these ideas out there. Do we do mandatory rental unit registration? Do we do mandatory inspections? Do we do these other sorts of services? And as the council makes those choices, we'll have to make an assessment of the staffing needs. So it could stay just as a part of the policy and data analytics team. You know, the policy team and the data team work very closely. Or if council chooses to really ramp up the service level and regulatory level, then it may become a standalone program team. Or at some point, even a standalone office. But when you transition to a new office, that becomes very, very expensive. Because you have a director, HR, business ops support, things like that.
There was an effort to get another project in South Waterfront, an advocacy effort, and I think there was a competitive process that I think, Javier, I'm not sure if it get run through the Bureau and it was awarded to Bridge Housing? That process to get another building in South Waterfront, mm-hmm. and there was a competitive process, was awarded to Bridge Housing. Yeah. If you're so somebody asked me in the community, currently on that lot, there's a parking lot, right. And it says OHSU parking lot. And they said, well, I thought they were breaking ground in 2017. How would I track on that? And I didn't know what the answer was to that.
So we're still negotiating. We are still not negotiating, let me rephrase that. Bridge still trying to complete its financing. We are on track to close this year, and construction should begin shortly thereafter, whether it's late this year or early next year. But we're on track on breaking ground.
Is there anywhere that, like just a citizen who was involved with that could go to a website and see that without calling you and bothering you, or
not so much? Yeah, at the moment in time we don't, because nothing has closed, and okay. All those dates are tentative.
Okay.
And so we don't want to put something out there that all of a sudden, you know, there's a timeline and we have not met that timeline, those issues. So this has been a tremendous amount of work that has happened, because of, as we talked about, inflationary influence in terms of development of construction, as well as the tax credit pricing and other market factors that has led to gap in financing and this delay. So, but I think that Bridge has identified all the funding resources and is going to go through that final process so we can close. Hopefully our goal is later this year, towards the end of this year.
Right. I would only add that Carl, who manages our multifamily team, he does provide a production pipeline report. It's very high level. It doesn't have, like Javier said, it doesn't get into the detailed timeline around milestones, but it gives general status of each of the Housing Bureau projects every month to PHAC, our advisory commission.
Oh, okay.
And then that document is on the website as a part of the PHAC materials. So that'd be a place where a regular production pipeline update would be available to the general public.
So I would just add that I just stepped out to take a call with Cynthia Parker, the president of Bridge, specifically on this project. The affordable housing piece is financed. It's done. And we're, as mentioned, we're scheduled to close, which means that they will buy the land from PDC and they will begin construction. It is a parking garage with two towers. One is a market rate tower and one is an affordable tower. You'll find it slightly ironic that the market rate tower currently has a gap. The affordable housing is covered. So they're struggling with whether or not they phase the project, build the market rate housing 18 months after they build the affordable housing. And it's complicated somewhat by the softening of the market rate market. So the rents that have been postulated might not be attained, and they're dealing with construction cost inflation that we talked about earlier. So, you know, they're working through those issues. There are no fatal flaws to the particular project, and if they have to phase it, we're okay with that. We wouldn't have allowed them, however, to build the market rate housing without the affordable housing, because that was granted to them as a mixed income deal.
Yeah.
But if we get the affordable housing slightly ahead of schedule, that's fine with us.
Well, and Susan, just so you know, in terms of the website and external communications, the communications team is right now working on a redesign of the website, the PHB website. We deal with the city's infrastructure. They require us to have a certain really difficult web presence. But one of the goals would be to have better listings of, because there, you know, there are dozens and dozens of projects in place that I don't think people know about, and be able to have that available so they at least know what's coming, with maybe not an exact pipeline schedule, but, you know, something that gives a better indication of dates, and also so that, you know, we, because this will come up, I think, with the bond, is the communications team is already in conversations to have a separate outside city website, just because it's so unwieldy, directly for the bond. And we haven't moved that far yet, but that's in process, that would then link to the PHB site, but a separate identity for the bond itself and the bond related projects.
That's great.
So they're diligently working on it, and I would expect we'll have something soon. Stay tuned for me, so I don't have any details on that. I get to use that excuse for at least another week. So, both of those things are actually in process. So.
Would it also be possible to leverage the existing framework of Portland Maps? I think that's generally the first place that I send people. And, you know, in previous iterations, you can get permit data, like changed hands. And so for someone to have to go to multiple websites,
That's a great suggestion. That we could
it'd be a lot cheaper,
Maps to
I mean,
do.
It's up.
It is?
So we've been in discussions with Portland Maps for existing buildings on adding a layer in there for where there is affordable housing that's regulated by the city. And I'm sure we could probably integrate future affordable housing in there as well. So if it's not up right now, it should be up in weeks to come. We've already sent all the GIS layers and the data file over to whoever it is, I don't know, it's somewhat either BTS or BPS that manages the hub and manages the upload to Portland Maps. So it should be there either now or very, very soon.
Yeah, because I think generally what I see is people get triggered by a permit or something like that, and that means they're already on Portland Maps. So
yeah.
For them to have to go somewhere else and
I know for sure we have not in that initiative, we didn't talk about incorporating the future, the pipeline, but their sites, so we can easily do that without a timeline on there. So I think we can make that addition to the request to the Portland Maps administrators.
Do you know how the data is going to be segregated for portal housing units? There's a lot of layers, right? I mean, is it going to be your investments? Is it going to be LIHTC? Because actually, what I'm thinking of is the application for the SAG selection and location criteria is part of is proximity to other affordable housing units.
So we for the Portland Maps, that'll just be fairly sure that'll just be the buildings that the Housing Bureau regulates. So we regulate about, I would say by now we're probably up to about 14,000. We were just under 13,800, but we're probably close to 14,000 given the volume in the pipeline and how many buildings are coming online in the city of Portland. But there are 20,000 regulated units in the city of Portland, around 20,000. Because Metro doesn't count every 5 years. They just released their latest plant count. It's somewhere around 20, 21,000 in the entire city. And so a lot of those are, all of those are units that did not get any Housing Bureau financing. So there's some Home Forward units in there, as well as other CDC, or even perhaps for-profit developers that use some other LIHTC or state tax credits or state financing and never came to the Bureau asking for financing. And those we don't, because we don't really, it's not our data, and we don't know if there are concerns about identifying those buildings on Portland maps. But we have the full data set, we have the full map. So as far as to the SAG exercise question, we have that and we can map out the entire city. We just wouldn't want to do something live online without getting permission from the other owners.
I really think most of them would be okay with it. You know, I think Kirkland Union Banner comes to mind. They're obviously a 202 operator of senior housing mostly, and they're in East Moreland, and they're in Anchorage, and they're taking HUD money. They're not taking our money, but they're using federal resources for those projects. So my guess is that even the tax credit owners, the Yards at Union Station, which I'm not sure how much money we actually have in each phase, there are five phases. I know that phase one and two were sold to Home Forward, so they would show up in their inventory. Phase three, four, and five were kept by GSL, Skip Grodal. So, you know, I think we should probably assume that that's in the public domain, maybe as a courtesy, just notify the owners that this is our intent. Unless we hear from you otherwise, we intend to post it, you know, because it's part of our data set, and if they've accepted public resources, I think it's pretty hard for them to argue that they're somehow examined, you know.
Yeah, I think for the general public, I mean, they don't need
they don't care
what you guys know, right? Yeah. But to go and be able to pull something up and know, I mean, in Portland maps that it's in an urban area or whatever, and be able to, oh, okay, they've either got a tax abatement of something having to, that's affordable housing. I think that's enough for people, or for them to know this will soon be something. Because you can already do a search right now based off of an owner. So I envision a world where, as the bond moves forward, the owner will be PHB, and so someone could just do a search in Portland Maps, anything owned by PHB, and then there'd be some other layer where it could drop down to housing bond. Where I think that would be enough for most people to be like, oh, there's 30 projects right now.
Yeah.
The website with pretty pictures of future buildings is also a great idea.
I think it's great. It just, it usually, I think we're great as a city of doing those things. It's just then they don't necessarily get updated. Yeah. And there's a lot of energy first, but then 2 years later, it's like, oh, that's still the same pictures.
I think our website has pictures of Tracy Manning.
I mean, we have the best of the 10. It's just, you know, I'm thinking about 7 years down the line. It's like, oh, Cupid doesn't look like that. Cupid probably will.
Cupid.
You make, that's why I'm just taking the old
pictures. Any other questions?
Ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
I guess I have a quick question. Sorry, it's going to take too much time, but the framework plan, is the staffing, the staff that you're adding going to be driven a little bit by this framework plan, or how will that interact, considering that's driving a lot of decisions for the bond?
I don't think the framework plan itself would increase or decrease staffing levels. I can't think of how. I mean, I would defer to Javier.
I mean, we understand, have an idea as to what is needed to bring the goals to fruition. What the framework plan is, it just gives a direction, right? And so we've done everything else around here to the degree that we think is possible to staff to be able to be successful and execute an effective plan. So I don't think it has any an impact, a direct impact on staffing. Now, if it's extremely successful and we do it faster than expected, then that may put a pressure on staff. But the plan is helpful.
Bob, here, I can see if we got a bold in construction, that we're having more construction management, we might have to look at doing something. A little more capacity, that would be more of a short term. I don't think maybe a 3 to 4 year period a little long, but really a lot depends on how things stage.
Yeah, I think that would be, and I don't think we've discussed it as a SAG, the sort of time horizons, right? If we see a bubble coming and we say, well, maybe it would behoove us to move quicker. Then you might have to, because you probably have a plan right now for staffing in response to this timeline around acquisition and new construction. But suppose if the committee said, wow, we really think you should accelerate so we can capture opportunities quicker and not get back up on a rise, then that's the kind of thing that would impact staffing.
Yeah. And I think that some of that will be, you know, things that you recommend too. I mean, once the framework plan is completed, which we would hope reaches that completion point, but then I think that part of what you'll get to your charter is also helping the Bureau make recommendations on it, adapting that plan, because, you know, I think the market is going to be a dynamic situation, and maybe there are situations where you help us in determining that, because I don't think that what the SAG will do will be able to live for all of the 5 to 7 years of the bond, and I think that you'll have to help us make recommendations. I would imagine that we'd go back to council for any potential changes.
Should y'all talk about the city attorney's role, Matthew?
No, not yet. No.
Yeah. So we have agreed with Tracy Reeve that we were buying an additional half FTE of city attorney time specifically for the bond. So heretofore, they don't like to keep time cards, right? Most of these folks came out of the private sector because they didn't like billable hours. But we're going back to billable hours because we need to be able to track their time. So they have a new attorney that will be on our account. Kevin.
Ken.
Is, he came to us, you know, he had a private practice, he had a small proprietorship. So you'll have some face time with him, going forward. We still have one FTE from Lisa Gramp covered with TIF and other resources. So we'll have 1.5 FTEs in total. It doesn't really show up on our org chart because they're not part of our staff, but they are part of our expense.
Any other questions for Matt in regard to?
Not until his next presentation.
Yeah. All right, I don't think I've gotten any more today.
Thanks, Matt. Well done.
Thanks, Matt.
Appreciate it. We have a couple of minutes before our break, so we will take our break and we will come back at the appointed moment. We'll go all the way to 10:30, so get 3 extra minutes. Use them well.